Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement today by Rick Santorum that he is suspending his campaign and discuss the reasons why with Will Bunch, an award-winning senior writer with the Philadelphia Daily News. He has followed the career of the former Pennsylvania senator who was soundly rejected by the state's voters in 2006 and was likely facing a similar fate in the Republican primary 2 weeks away. Then we will speak with George Gale, the executive director of National People's Network. He is helping lead the 99% Spring and 99% Power, training 100,000 activists in April and organizing demonstrations at upcoming shareholder meetings of some of the biggest, most abusive, and least accountable corporations in America. Then finally, as Tax Day looms, we will examine how your taxes are spent by the federal government and how the spending is prioritized. Mattia Kramer, a senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project, joins us. They just released the report, Tax Day 2012, that gives the numbers down to the penny on how your federal income taxes were spent in fiscal 2011. Joining us now is Will Bunch, an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News and a senior fellow with Media Matters for America. He blogs at attitude.com, that's attitytyTOOD.com, and is the author of Tear Down This Myth, The Right-Wing Distortion of the Reagan Legacy. And his latest book is The Backlash, Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. Welcome to Background Briefing, Will Bunch.
Hey, Ian, thanks so much for having me back on the show. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you too, Will. And your state senator who was, he was finished, right, put a fork in him in 2006, soundly rejected by Pennsylvania's voters, and yet he managed to come back. And for a while there, he looked like he could even become the Republican nominee for president of the United States.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating that, you know, Pennsylvania was the state that obviously put an end to Santorum 1.0, and now it looks like we've put an end to Santorum 2.0, because I think really, you know, there were a number of factors, obviously, that went into his decision that he announced today, but I think the biggest one was he really felt, and I think rightfully so, that, the embarrassment of losing Pennsylvania yet again, you know, his supposed home state, although he's actually lived in Virginia for a number of years. But, you know, that just would have been too much. I mean, he's looking ahead to his future. I mean, I think he very much would like to run in 2016 if Romney loses the election in the fall. And I think, you know, the fact that he's been so soundly rejected by the voters who know him best here in Pennsylvania would be quite a cross for him to bear if he tried to do that. He did, probably the smart thing politically and got out.
So the polls were pretty clear, weren't they, that he was going to lose? And then Romney had barely begun to spend the $2 million that he'd budgeted for the state of Pennsylvania.
Right. Well, the polls showed was just incredible momentum towards Romney in that back before people were paying attention a couple months ago, you know, Santorum did have the huge edge in name recognition here, and he did have a big lead in the polls, the first couple polls that were done in Pennsylvania. But then as the primary got closer, the latest round of polls showed the race was basically a dead heat, you know, that maybe Santorum had a statistically insignificant lead. And as you said, I mean, this was all before Santorum was ready to spend $2 or $3 million blitzing the state on ads. And in fact, those ads started running yesterday. I mean, they supposedly were going to pull them because of the illness of Santorum's daughter, but because you can't just quickly pull ads from the TV schedule, I guess, they actually were running all day yesterday, and I think you know, Santorum didn't have any money to match that, and I think the negative ad blitz would have just destroyed Santorum and the state, and it would have been you know, if he'd lost Pennsylvania by 5, 10, 15 points, it just would have been quite an embarrassment for him.
So what is the status of his three-year-old daughter, Isabella? She has a rare genetic disorder and apparently has lived well beyond her life expectancy.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It does have a very short life expectancy, unfortunately, and trisomy 18, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. It's a chromosomal disorder, and she's been in the hospital a couple times this year. I think she was in the hospital over the weekend, I believe, with pneumonia. But she has been released, and I mean, so far, you know, the most recent news is positive in that she's out of the hospital, and that's, I think we all certainly can agree, that's very good news, and we're all happy to hear that. And that's something that obviously weighed on his decision too. I mean, it just when you look at all the factors, it just seemed like this was the time for Santorum to get out. It was kind of a no brainer. You know, he had this situation with his daughter, and would have lost Pennsylvania and damaged his reputation. And now he basically lives to fight another day, as the cliche goes. You know, that he, I think he sees himself. I think he sees three very positive things coming out of this. And I would agree with Santorum that I see these positive things coming out of this too, which are, number one, you know, he's, for better or worse, established himself as kind of the leader of the conservative movement in this country right now, or certainly the face of the conservative movement more than any of the other people who, you know, dropped out of the race a long time ago. So that's number one. I mean, number two, I mean, he's, I think, set the stage for a campaign in 2016, and we all know that the Republicans have a history of giving the nomination to the candidate who came in second the time before, and I think he's looking at that. And the other thing many pointed out is that, I mean, he was already doing pretty well financially as a consultant and a pundit and a lobbyist, a rainmaker before, but I'm sure his income value has increased because of his higher name recognition. So he'll certainly probably do very well financially next year or so. You know, I think everything out of this campaign, if you're Rick Santorum and you're looking at this campaign, I think you'd have to look at everything that came out of it as pretty much a positive for him, even though he didn't get the nomination. I mean, that was always going to be a long shot without having the money you really need to get a nomination in this day and age, and without having the really any support from party insiders at all. So I think he really did the best he possibly could have, to be honest.
Again, I'm speaking with Will Bunch, an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. He's also a senior fellow at Media Matters for America. And we're talking about Rick Santorum pulling out of the race today in a speech he gave in Gettysburg. He said we're not done fighting. And he also apparently after the speech, by the way, Will, in the speech, I don't think there was any mention of Romney. At all.
Well, no, he certainly has not endorsed Mitt Romney. You know, I would imagine that might come at some point if he wants to guarantee that he gets a primetime speaking spot at the convention in Tampa, which I'm sure that he does. No, I mean, you know, I think that's not surprising given, you know, just given the millions and millions of dollars that Romney spent on attack ads in Santorum. I mean, there's a lot of short-term hard feelings there, and I'm sure at some point, you know, with his future in mind, I'm sure Santorum will probably endorse him at some point, but clearly today wasn't the day he was going to do that.
So, Will Bunch, what explained his fighting words? And, you know, they were not done fighting, and against all odds, we won 11 states, millions of voters, millions of votes, and then after that, of course, in Gettysburg, after his speech, he joined up with Focus in the Family's James Dobson, who's the sort of de facto head of the religious right.
Well, right. Well, I mean, the kind of two interrelated things are behind those words, I think. One is that, you know, he truly sees himself as the leader of a movement. I mean, he feels that he's leading a crusade, you know, for family values, like you said, and to restore a more socially conservative outlook in this country. I think he also believes that, you know, he would be the protector of the Middle East against, you know, Islamic extremism and a nuclear Iran and all that. And I think he does, you know, in his own mind, he takes these issues very seriously. And then the other thing is, I think he, you know, he's a student of politics and he looks at the history and sees how Ronald Reagan, his hero, parlayed a losing campaign in 1976 into you know, becoming the leader of the conservative movement at that time, and then took it on to the presidency in 1980. And I mean, clearly, I mean, there's no doubt this is the template that Santorum sees for himself. And there are some similarities. I mean, there are differences too. I mean, Reagan was not nearly as gaffe prone, I would say, as Santorum is, and you know, I mean, just some of the some of the wacky things that Santorum has said in this campaign about the, you know, accusing Obama of snobbery for wanting people to go to college, or, you know, things he said about maybe the Crusades weren't such a bad thing. I mean, just some of the wacky things he says are not particularly Reagan-esque. So it'll be interesting to see, I'm not a big fan, I'm greatly understating it, but I'm not a fan at all of Santorum's ideology or his ideas. But I mean, is a political figure to watch. He's always held some fascination, and I think he's going to continue to do so for better or worse for the next 4 years.
Well, Will Bunch, you mentioned Reagan's, because Reagan made one of the greatest political speeches ever in his concession to Gerald Ford. When I think everybody in that hall, every Republican said, "Oh God, we've got the wrong guy," you know. There is that sort of ritual.
I think Santorum is really hoping to go for that in Tampa this summer. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, the two-party conventions are shaping up as even duller affairs than usual, if that's possible. And you know, Santorum's speech that you might expect him to probably give in Tampa, it might be the one moment of liveliness that might be worth watching.
Well, the speech he gave today, though, was I thought in a way was pretty much his veiled way of saying, you know, who he really represents, which is, for a Republican, he really went out of his way to talk about his modest upbringing and his working class roots, etc.
I think if you saw the speech he gave after the Iowa caucuses, I thought he gave a very politically effective speech that night on the same topic. And, you know, absolutely. I mean, we've seen this evolution over the course of our lifetime in this country from a time when the working class was still, in the orbit of the New Deal, and you still, you know, saw the last stages of the FDR coalition holding together, you know, when working class people, viewed, you know, unions and progressive ideas as kind of their way to a better future. And, for better or worse, I think Santorum has his pulse on a large element of that now disgruntled working class, in the American heartland, who have been won over the last 50 years by conservatism. And I think Mitt Romney is a classic example of a Republican who connects very poorly with that key element of the party. And, I think Santorum realizes, perhaps correctly, that if he can become the voice of these people from places like Wisconsin and Minnesota and Colorado, who, maybe displaced former factory workers who are very disgruntled, but who blame liberalism for a lot of their woes, people who listen to talk radio and watch the Fox News channel. I mean, those are the people that I think, along with obviously his base of evangelicals, that Santorum sees as the wave he hopes to ride possibly to the White House in 2016 or 2020. I mean, he's only 53 years old, so, 20 years younger than John McCain was last time around. So he's got plenty of time to create Santorum 3.0, for better or worse. And I would, having watched his career, I would fully expect that to happen.
Well, I was going to say that Will Bunch, that he's in exalting and explaining his working class roots and talking about the ordinary people that touched his heart and whose hearts he's touched during this campaign. It was clearly a way to contrast himself with the 1% candidate that the Republicans are running.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I want to be clear about one thing, which is, I mean, if you actually look at the way Santorum governed when he was in the U.S. Senate, I mean, he, you know, as much as any other Republican, basically fought for the 1%, you know, I mean...
He's been living off the 1%, hadn't he? Hadn't he been a lobbyist?
He's become one of the 1% just in the 6 years since he left office. He makes, $900,000 to $1 million a year as a lobbyist and a TV pundit, but mainly as being a lobbyist, working for coal companies and drug companies whose issues he championed when he was a senator. So
that's why he moved to Virginia, to be in Northern Virginia.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's become the base of his operations, and he's very successful. You know, he's become a very successful businessman, and like I said earlier in the interview, I think he's going to be even in a more successful orbit financially in the next 4 years. And who knows? I mean, he may find like Mike Huckabee or Sarah Palin. He may find that, you know, being on TV and doing these other activities is so lucrative. He may just change his mind and decide not to run for president in 2016 because he may be making too much money. I mean, it's a sad commentary on today's politics, but you see that more and more often.
Well, but he's a bit of a stiff, isn't he? I mean, he's such a tightly wound guy. I don't see him as any kind of TV personality. But I guess he was on Fox.
He's very different from Huckabee. You're absolutely right in that regard. Although, odd as it sounds, I thought he was actually more relaxed and less overbearing in this campaign than he was when he represented Pennsylvania. So,
Well, he's certainly among the few of them that can actually give a speech and doesn't need a teleprompter.
Absolutely. When you think back on some of the things that a Rick Perry or some of the things that a Herman Cain said during the campaign, Santorum's obviously said a number of bizarre things, but being knowledgeable and understanding the issues is not one of his problems. So.
Right.
Yeah,
being a mental patient in a sweater suit may be one of his problems.
Admiring the Crusades was a problem.
Right,
so,
right.
And
homeschooling and being against college education and essentially wanting to take us back to the days of the Puritans, you know.
Yeah, well, and the focus on contraception. I mean, this is something that most of us thought was just. Whoever thought that this would be an issue again in a presidential election?
Well, I guess birth control.
I mean, sure, I totally understand why abortion is an issue, but I mean, birth control. I mean, these are things that we just thought were settled matters back in the era of Mad Men, you know, and
sure.
We are in 2012 debating about birth control again.
Well, thanks to Rick Santorum. I mean, but just in closing, Will Bunch. Clearly, even though he had a perfunctory conversation with Mitt Romney, Romney's got to make some kind of deal with this guy because he does have a lot of delegates. But the real issue is that since he is the candidate, Santorum, of the South, of the religious right, and he met today with James Dobson, if the religious right stay home, in this election, then Romney's toast. So Romney has to find a way to work with Santorum to bring the religious right back into the fold and to fire them up sufficiently to come out and vote.
Right. I mean, he needs. He's kind of in the same position that John McCain was in 4 years ago, in that McCain felt this need to add Sarah Palin to his ticket. And I'm not saying that Romney would add Santorum to his ticket. I would think that would be highly unlikely. But Romney has the same problem in that he needs to excite that base of the party, the Tea Party, you know, and the evangelical and Southern voters, because there's a lot of states where if those folks don't turn out, they would go from narrow victories for the GOP to narrow defeats. I think Romney has a pretty uphill climb right at the moment. Already, and
nevertheless, the Republican establishment is breathing a huge sigh of relief. I think they thought they were going to have a Goldwater blowout.
If this had dragged on, absolutely. Every week this went on, it just got worse and worse. But I think already, I mean, my take on it is that Romney is already in such a deep hole at this point. Honestly, I'm not sure how much more damage could have been done because most of it's been done already.
Well, Will Bunch, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks again, Ian. I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Will Bunch, an award-winning senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News and a senior fellow with Media Matters for America. He blogs at attitude.com. That's attitywtwod.com. And he's the author of Tear Down This Myth, The Right-Wing Distortion of the Reagan Legacy. His latest book is The Backlash, Right-Wing Radicals, High-Def Hucksters, and Paranoid Politics in the Age of Obama. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with one of the organizers of the 99% Spring. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is George Gale, the Executive Director of National People's Action, a network of metropolitan and statewide membership organizations dedicated to advancing economic and racial justice. Currently is helping lead 99% Spring, an effort designed to train 100,000 people during a one-week period in April to engage in nonviolent direct action to advance a vision of a new economy, as well as 99% power, an unprecedented number of demonstrations leading up to and at the spring shareholder meetings of some of the most abusive and unaccountable corporations in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Gale.
Hey, I'm glad to be here.
And clearly the Occupy movement and the extent to which the notion of the 99% versus the 1% has become completely cemented in the political lexicon and in the national zeitgeist, if you will, in a curious way, it caught all of the sort of professional political activists by surprise. Just a group of people just decided to go out and do something, and they did it, and they caught the nation's attention. And then the various police departments, starting with the NYPD, closed them down. But it's not out of business, right? It's dormant, just like how things go dormant in the winter and then they blossom in the spring.
I think that's right. I mean, I think we're going to see a serious uprising of people power this spring. And the same issues and the same concerns that, you know, drove people into action in the fall are still here. They've not been addressed. So I think we're going to see people hitting the streets in different forms. It may not be occupying parks, but it's going to be certainly occupying shareholder meetings. I will say, I think one of the reasons the Occupy movement really took off is that the people that organized it really didn't pull any punches. There's a lot of folks in the progressive sector who spend a lot of time, you know, looking at polling and parsing messaging and trying to be sure they got the exact right language. And Occupy Wall Street, in particular, of the different Occupy-like occupations, just came out and really said, hey, Wall Street, big corporations, these guys are the culprit, and we need to take it directly at them. And then they push very clearly the inequality narrative, and that's been one of the biggest gifts that Occupy has given us, the 99% versus the 1% narrative.
So is there divisions within the movement? I've been reading articles that suggest there's a kind of Occupy purity movement, and then there's the more inclusive aspects of the movement. I mean, nobody owns this movement, do they?
No, nobody owns both the ideas of nonviolent direct action or the ideas of restructuring our economy and our democracy. But there's lots of different people that are really frustrated and believe we need transformative change in this country. And there will be different ideas around how we get there. I think the thing we can all agree on is that, you know, we've found the enemy, and it's not us. It's not, you know, communities of color. It's not immigrants. It's not working class families. It's not unions. It's not government. But it's the folks on Wall Street and the folks that run the big corporations who've clearly hijacked our democracy and are making inequality more and more rampant today. So I think what we're going to see is people come together this spring, particularly around the shareholder meetings, because I think people know that's where the power's at.
And the first one coming up, I take it, is Coca-Cola later this month. I noticed that Coca-Cola just pulled out of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, who are the ones that are behind all the voter suppression laws that are being passed in state legislatures, and also the ones that propagated the Stand Your Ground law that is responsible for the death of Trayvon Martin down in Florida.
I think that's right. And I think that every corporation, you know, should leave ALEC. And I think we also need to, as John Nichols pointed out in The Nation the other day, really challenge all elected officials that are members of ALEC to pull out. Because Stand Your Ground, which is front and center right now and should be, is another extension of what we saw with SB 1070 laws that really went after immigrants in this country and started with SB 1070 in Arizona. But that was an ALEC-created vehicle that has then been copycatted around the country. One of the big shareholder meetings that you will see the most people come to this spring, though, will be in San Francisco, the Wells Fargo shareholder meeting. There will be thousands of people there on April 24th showing up to protest.
And what about the Bank of America shareholder meeting in May? Because I noticed, and I'm surprised that this didn't get more publicity, the Dallas Fed came out with a very, very bold statement only a week or so ago saying that the big banks should be broken up, and this too big to fail phenomenon is going to come back and bite us again. And they were referring to Bank of America specifically.
I think that's right. I mean, if there's any bank that's bad for America, it's Bank of America. And I think what is amazing is, well, one, in 1997, there were 39 banks that by 2009 had merged into four banks. And the exact banks that we had to bail out, the Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and J.P. Morgan Chase in particular, all actually got bigger. So they were too big to fail, and now they're like much too big to fail. So we have to address the question of too big to fail if we're going to really protect our economy. But too big to fail is not only a threat to our economy, it's a threat to our democracy. These guys have too much control over the politics and legislation of this country, and we've got to take them to task. So in Charlotte on May 9th, there'll be tons of people from the state of North Carolina and from the region busing in to the shareholder meeting in Charlotte. And I know in North Carolina there'll be a whole month of action leading up to the May 9th shareholder meeting. And it's important to note that the shareholder meeting is in Charlotte, North Carolina, which is also where the Democratic National Convention is going to be. So we expect a lot of activity in that state.
And the Democratic Convention will be in June or July? I can't remember now.
I can't remember either. Later, in the summer, but definitely afterwards.
Right. And then of course, what I do remember about the choice of North Carolina is a lot of the union members who've supported the Democratic Party over the decades are not too happy that the convention is taking place in a non-union state.
Yeah, that's not going over too well with a number of...
Right. But on that subject... Within the 99% movement itself, there's all, you know, I've spoken to a number of people over since it began, and there's some sense of it being apolitical, not wanting to be co-opted by political parties, etc. Is that argument still going on? Because it seems to me the notion that the movements now, including people like MoveOn.org, the United Auto Workers, Greenpeace, Rebuild the Dream, the Communication Workers of America, it doesn't seem to me like they're trying to co-opt the Occupy movement so much as the Occupy movement has co-opted them.
I think that's a good way of saying it. I think that, you know, the Occupy movement has like created new space for people to really say what they believe. And I think if we're serious about transforming the economics and politics of this country, more of us have to close that gap between saying what we truly believe and then what we're comfortable saying. And so I think the Occupy movement is the best example of serious truth tellers. And so I think it has opened up new space that has moved people in another direction. You know, and I will say that, like, a lot, you know, it's funny, people talk about, like, well, is this, you know, why is Move On doing this? It's like, we should all be celebrating that Move On is calling to train a bunch of people in nonviolent direct action. I mean, who would have predicted that 5 years ago or 2 years ago? So I think I would just encourage anybody that's concerned about that to spend more time thinking about what a great sign of progress that this is, and that more and more people are going to hit the streets. Because I'm certain of this, there is no road to like transformative change that doesn't include both going toe to toe with corporate power, and it doesn't include moving more people into the streets. Like, we are kidding ourselves if we think we're going to really change this country without doing those two things. And so the fact that all these different organizations and institutions are moving that direction is something we've got to celebrate, we've got to get behind it, and we've got to help push it.
Well, clearly the Occupy movement doesn't have a monopoly on political action, a direct action. I mean, it was the unions who led the occupation of the Wisconsin Capitol, which has led now to the recall of the governor. And groups like 350.org led these mass demonstrations and arrests in front of the White House that forced the White House to postpone plans for the Keystone XL pipeline. So I take it the point here, George Gale, is that everyone's welcome, right? As long as you're prepared to get off the couch and turn off the TV and open the door and take to the streets.
I think that's right. The one kind of caveat, and I think this is really important, is that our allegiance does need to be to a set of ideas and principles, not to a political party. And so as long as we stay aligned with those big ideas, stay aligned with our principles, we can then shift the politics of the country in a different direction. But if we try to soften our message and figure out how this works through the polls and figure out how do we just speak to the middle, even though I would argue the middle is as angry as anybody, that then we're going to have mush. But we need to be out there, stay aligned with what we believe, and then we can shift things.
Well, recently I host the UCLA Hammer Forum here in Los Angeles, and we had Lawrence Lessig, speak with us, and he's a leading advocate of getting money out of politics. And he made the point, which I think is actually really a better way to frame the current political situation. He's made the point that, you know, our politics are distracted essentially by the left versus the right and vice versa, that the real divide in America is between the insiders and the outsiders.
I mean, I think that it's certainly a divide between kind of, you know, elite and non-elite is something you're certainly seeing. And if you, you know, I travel all across the country meeting with our members, and people are feeling really closed out, both of like where kind of big decisions get made around our economy, but also around our politics. So there may be something to that, though. I do think that there is a kind of a worldview and an ideology that is important for us to stick with around, you know, ensuring human dignity and work and in the community, to ensuring people have, you know, access to real opportunity. And I think that one of the things we've got to figure out is how do we move more and more both, you know, money and political power into the hands of more people. And maybe that's something that Lawrence would agree with. I would say that if we don't address the money in politics question, you know, it's just going to be a tough road for a long time.
But do you think, George Gale, that there is any way to say, you know, I wouldn't suggest form a coalition with the Tea Party, but in many ways, the Tea Party is made up of working people, middle-class people. A lot of people, of course, make the argument that they're acting and voting against their interests, but they did start as a response to the Wall Street bailout. And many people argue that that was the moment when the Occupy movement should have began, and the vacuum was filled by the Tea Party. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I mean, I would say, and that's something I've spent a lot of time thinking about. I think kind of following the financial crisis and then the election of Obama, that you know, progressive sector broadly failed to come in and very clearly kind of define who got us here and how we got here. And I think that, you know, in short would be Wall Street. And we didn't fill that and help people make meaning of the moment in the way that we needed to. We could debate forever the reasons we didn't do that. But in that hole, I think that the Tea Party and corporate conservatives came in and helped create another narrative and meaning around the moment, and that led to the growth of the Tea Party. So I do think there was a failure there. I would say, you know, that what is unique about this economic moment and what gives me hope around how we turn a really dire circumstance into something more positive is the fact that you really do have a majoritarian possibility in terms of, you have communities of color who've been shut out of this economy for a long time. You have young people who are feeling particularly shut out right now, and you have working class families of all races feeling very shut out. So I think people are ready to galvanize around a set of big ideas, but I think if we go in for small ideas and small transactional change, that is not going to inspire and build a movement. But if we shoot for big ideas around restructuring how our economy works and who it works for, that's going to inspire people. But we can't be tepid and weak around naming who got us here. And if we continue to be that way collectively, we're going to be in trouble.
So it's not inconceivable then that some common ground could be forged in the future.
I think that's right. I mean, I'm not sure it's common ground with the Tea Party per se, but I do think that there are a lot of folks that might describe themselves as middle Americans or independents who are incredibly frustrated. And I'll just take our organization, National People's Action. We organized up until Occupy. We organized and put more people into the streets, pressuring the banks and Wall Street and the financial sector than any other organization. But if you looked at who came to our protests, I mean, this was very heartland, middle America, church-going folks who were just really upset that the banks had created this crisis and had gotten away with it. And so people who had never been to demonstrations in their lives took over the American Bankers Association conference here in Chicago, went to Wall Street to march on Wall Street, shut down K Street in Washington, D.C., went to the J.P. Morgan Chase shareholder meeting and built a bridge to cross the moat that surrounded their headquarters there. And if you saw the photos from these protests, this does not look, these are not professional protesters. These are not you know, people you often imagine in your head as protesters. These are folks that just see something egregiously wrong in this moment. And I would say in many cases, certainly don't identify as progressive. I don't know if they identify as independent or conservative, but just people that want to see justice.
Well, just in closing, George Gale, as the 99% spring gets underway and you're helping lead it, and you're about to train or beginning to train 100,000 people during this month of April to engage in nonviolent direct action, and also unprecedented numbers of demonstrations are going to be taking place leading up to the spring shareholder meetings of some of the big corporations that dominate our economy and own our politics. Give us a sense of some of the training that's going on here. For example, I was reading that you're going to be training tens of thousands of people in arrest techniques. Wouldn't that be arrest avoidance techniques?
Oh, yeah. I don't know where you got that, but I think that...
I read that in the Huffington Post. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Well, that's probably wrong. But the... three things people are really going to engage in these trainings is, one, really kind of placing people's individual stories in the broader economic context is kind of the opening of the training. The second is really one part, a kind of analysis of this economic moment and how we got here. And related is actually people engaging in some visioning of what a new economy kind of with our values at the foundation might look like. And third, really around the history and practice, both kind of theory and the practical around nonviolent direct action. So preparing people to move this spring into the streets in ways that are beyond rallies and press conferences and marches, but more direct action focused, you know, not solely on corporate targets, but in particular on corporate targets.
Well, but much of the criticism of the Occupy movement, particularly from Fox News, which is frankly, a lot of it's just purely manufactured, is about people occupying city halls and strewing garbage around and all of that kind of stuff. Is there training in sensitivity towards? Because isn't it true, George, that there's the Occupy movement is not just the people in the tents. It's those millions and millions of Americans that you talked about who support the Occupy movement and show up at demonstrations that are also a part of it, even if they're not in the tents.
And
it would seem to me that the best way to disinfect the negative propaganda from Fox News is to eliminate their propaganda, the possibility of their propaganda.
Right. Well, first, I agree it's total propaganda, and then second, I think this people will be trained to engage in disciplined, nonviolent direct action that really speaks to the moral authority of our cause and of the moment. And so we will definitely be drawing on the lessons from our, forefathers and foremothers in this work. And so I think it will really, and that's one of the reasons for the training, is so people really kind of have the skills and expertise around this. National People's Action has been doing nonviolent direct action for 40 years, but in many periods over the last 40 years, we've been, kind of out in the wilderness alone and not seeing enough of it. So we and others who have, training techniques around this are going to bring that and share it with others.
Well, George Gale, I thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with George Gale, the Executive Director of the National People's Action, a network of metropolitan statewide membership organizations dedicated to advancing economic and racial justice. Currently, he is leading 99% Spring, an effort designed to train 100,000 people during a one-week period in April to engage in nonviolent direct actions to advance a vision of a new economy, as well as 99% power, an unprecedented number of demonstrations leading up to and at the spring shareholder meetings of some of the most abusive and unaccountable corporations in America. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about, since it's tax day is looming, about what happens to your tax money and the priorities on how it's spent.
Come on. nation millions, put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, beds in hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mattia Kramer, Senior Research Analyst at the National Priorities Project, a national non-profit, non-partisan research organization dedicated to making complex federal budget information transparent and accessible. The National Priorities Project just released the report Tax Day 2012, which gives the numbers on how federal income taxes are spent in fiscal 2011, down to the penny, giving people a tax receipt for how their money is spent. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mattia Kramer.
Thanks so much for having me.
And of course, the clock is ticking now on Tax Day. Normally, it's the 15th, which in this case is falling on a Sunday. So the IRS have extended the deadline till Tuesday, April the 17th, right?
That's right.
And you are providing us here with a service, which in many ways I wish the government provided, and that is a breakdown of where the tax dollars go. I take it that you have also tried, or your organization, the National Priorities Project, has tried to lobby the government to do what you do.
That's true. And in fact, the federal government used to do this and put out a citizen's guide to the federal budget, and it stopped in 2002 under the George W. Bush presidency.
And what was that citizen's guide? It did the similar breakdown of where your tax money goes?
Yes, and it gave citizens a lot of information about how the budget process works, how to influence it in terms of contacting elected officials, and a lot of powerful information about what's going on in Washington.
And what was the rationale for the George W. Bush administration for stopping this? I take it had been going on for years prior to 2002.
It had been going on for around a decade.
Uh-huh.
And the Bush administration decided that it was not a high enough impact program and discontinued it. We at National Priorities Project think that that was a grave mistake, and we've tried to step into the shoes of that citizen's guide. And in addition to putting out where your tax dollars went, we've actually come out with a book that'll be out in May called A People's Guide to the Federal Budget to do that very thing that the federal government used to do.
So just to go through some of the basic numbers here, the federal government income, the take, if you will, the federal government brought in terms of tax revenues, $1.13 trillion in fiscal 2011, and 27 cents of every federal income tax dollar went to the military, 21.4 cents went to Medicare and other health programs, 14.5 cents were paid for interest on the federal debt. They're the first three big numbers, right?
That's exactly right. That $1.13 trillion, that's our federal income tax dollars. The federal government also collects lots of other kinds of taxes, $1.13 trillion in income taxes alone.
And that doesn't include payroll taxes, which pay for Social Security and Medicare, and
exactly.
Corporate taxes and other government taxes. So just in terms of income tax distribution, the military is the most, as we mentioned. Care and health's the second. Interest on the debt's third. Social Security and labor is fourth. Government, that's out of your tax dollar, that's at 4.5 cents. What's that mean, government? That's just the operation of all the government departments?
Well, yes, and we have to pay for, we think of the judicial branch, right, as an important function of government in terms of adjudicating law, and so there's a real cost to running a judicial branch, and then, of course, the cost of maintaining a legislative branch and paying our lawmakers and their staff, and then the cost of having a president.
Then the next one down the list is 4.4 cents of every tax dollar goes to veterans' benefits. That's an interesting contrast, isn't it? Where 27 cents of every tax dollar goes to the military and only 4.4 cents goes to veterans.
That's right, and many people like to think of the veterans' benefits as part of military, and when you add it on to that 27 cents that goes to the military, well, that's more than a third of your federal income tax dollar now that goes to military and related programs.
And education is 2.5 cents of every tax dollar. That's pretty pathetic, isn't it, as a fraction?
You're exactly right, and that's where we get the most response from the public. Folks write into us, frankly, outraged that the funding for education is so low, and in particular, during our tough economic times, that includes money for community colleges, which are often important sites for retraining, for valuable programs that help people get back to work when they've been laid off. And so people, as you said, people find that 2.5 cents to be quite pathetic.
Well, it's pathetic when you consider that almost every politician running for office is always saying, you know, we've got to improve American education. But it doesn't seem to go any further than rhetoric. They don't actually put the money where their mouths are.
That's right. And it means that we have a job to do as citizens in contacting our elected officials and then voting some of them out of office who don't put their money where their mouth is.
Again, I'm speaking with Mattia Kramer, the senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project, a national nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization dedicated to making complex federal budget information transparent and accessible. The National Priorities Project just released their report, Tax Day 2012, which gives the numbers on how federal income taxes were spent in fiscal 2011, down to the penny, giving the people a tax receipt for how their money is spent. Mattia just told us that the federal government actually provided this service until George W. Bush ended it in 2002. So the bottom of the list is science, which gets 1 cent out of every dollar. Energy, by the way, and environment get 1.9%. Again, not declaring open season on bashing politicians, but you have to admit, Mattia, that politicians always talk about, you know, how we want to protect the environment and make ourselves free of dependence upon unstable regimes providing us with our energy needs and get free from foreign oil. How are we going to get free from foreign oil if only 1.9 cents of every tax dollar is spent on energy and environment?
That's exactly right. And what's so powerful about that is that once folks know where their tax dollars are going and then they see that that number is so low, when in fact they've been promised that energy and environment will become priorities, it's powerful to know that. That's how, for many people, knowing these numbers is how they become engaged and start to talk about the kind of politicians that they'd like to see in office.
So the other breakdown, and first of all, we should tell our listeners where they can get these very user-friendly charts that I'm looking at now. You've got also got interactive charts as well. So just tell us about what's available online and where our listeners can access it.
Certainly. Our website, nationalpriorities.org, offers this chance to get your own personalized tax receipt. And so if you go to interactive data and choose your tax receipt, once you've done your 2011 taxes, which are, as you said, the clock is ticking, once you've completed your taxes, you can enter the amount that you paid and find out exactly how many dollars you personally sent to each of these different areas of the federal government. And that's at nationalpriorities.org.
Well, you've got to hear a breakdown of the average taxpayer who's earning $30,000 a year annually. The average receipt is $2,654. And then you break that down in the military, again, gets $716.01 from the average taxpayer. That includes 18 cents for nuclear weapons. Medicare and health is $567, which includes 3 cents for maternal, infant, and early childhood home visiting programs. Social Security and labor, the third one, that's $323, including 15 cents for temporary assistance for needy families. Housing and community, you know, government is the Postal Service under attack, right? The government gets out of the average taxpayer pays $119. 84 cents of that goes to the Postal Service. Energy and environment, we talked about that, $51, including $6.19 for energy conservation. But here's one I think that'll get people's attention, particularly here in California. Transportation. The average taxpayer earning $30,000 a year gives the government $34 for transportation, which include 28 cents for high-speed rail. So we're certainly, you know, in terms of future investment in infrastructure and stuff like that, there's just no sense that any of this budget is talking about the future. It's just taking care of the big slices of the pie that have existed and continue to exist and dominate Washington.
It's very light on investment, as you said, in the science category is another example of where we could see a huge return on investment in years down the road from investing in scientific research, and we have just a pittance going to that. And transportation is another important example of that.
So you've included in this a lot of the, for example, here's the one in education. The average taxpayer earning 30,000 a year is paying $2,654 in federal income taxes. In terms of the money that they spent on education, $65 goes towards education, including 40 cents for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And that the CPB has become the whipping boy for the Republicans. I mean, 40 cents is hardly going to break the bank if that's all the average taxpayer gives to the CPB.
Yeah, that's right. Out of every dollar, it's 0.02 cents to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
So what explains then the current priorities? Is it just attrition? Is it just this is the way we've been doing business for decades? I mean, the Pentagon, of course, having the biggest slice of the pie, even though we're winding down the wars, my understanding is we're spending more now than on defense than we even spent during the Cold War. So what is your understanding, since you analyze these things, Mattia Kramer, of how we got to where we are, let alone how we are going to undo these priorities or reprioritize?
It's very difficult to roll back the amount of money that we spend on the military. It's politically a very difficult issue. And it's not because we haven't identified sources where we could cut back on military spending. There are kinds of military programs that are low impact now that we're no longer facing Cold War opponents. It's a different landscape in terms of where we need to invest in the military. And so there are programs that could be cut and savings could be created, but it's very difficult politically for lawmakers to accomplish that. So that's a big slice of the federal budget pie right there. Healthcare is another huge slice. And of course, as we hear about all the time, healthcare costs are growing. And the federal government has not yet figured out a way to hold down costs. There are promising proposals out there. It's another politically difficult issue. And our federal government has yet to tackle that one, as we know, certainly from hearing the Supreme Court hearings last week. So between the military and healthcare, that's a huge chunk of the pie that's gone and not available for science, for transportation, for education. And once we figure out how to wean ourselves from the kind of military spending that we've become accustomed to and to hold down healthcare costs, it will free up incredible resources to go to these kinds of long-term investments, the places where many Americans say they'd really like their tax dollars to go.
Well, Mattia Kramer, though, the third item on the list in terms of where your tax dollars go, out of every dollar of taxes that we pay the government, 14 cents goes to interest on the national debt. That's the third biggest item. That figure will give deficit hawks, put some wind at their back, won't it?
It does. It does. And it's not something that folks on the progressive side of the spectrum like to hear about. And it is the most compelling reason, in my opinion, to pay attention to our budget deficits, because there are real costs in terms of paying interest on that debt. And the cost is that every penny that goes to interest on the federal debt can't go to education, can't go to energy, can't go to transportation. And so we do have an interest in bringing deficits under control as our economy improves.
Well, but isn't it worth noting in terms of the interest on the debt, the 14.5 cents per dollar that the American taxpayers pay to service the interest on the debt? The debt is owned, right, by wealthy individuals and funds, right? I mean, mutual funds and pension funds, et cetera. And more importantly, the Chinese, right?
Yeah, international investors certainly hold a big slice. Domestic investors, as you say, mutual funds and regular people. Actually, what's interesting, though, is federal accounts hold quite a bit of the debt, which means that we've borrowed a lot of money from, or the federal government has borrowed money from itself, and mostly that's Social Security surpluses in previous years have been used to pay for general expenses, and that's money that needs to be paid back into the Social Security Trust Fund, especially as baby boomers retire.
So just in closing, Mattia, I was alarmed to learn from you that George W. Bush ended the federal government providing the kind of work that you do in terms of providing taxpayers with a kind of receipt for where their money is spent and how it's prioritized. And this, of course, is the president who has just gone public and said, George W. Bush has just gone public and said he doesn't like his name attached to the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy, which, of course, he unquestionably is responsible for. And, of course, the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy did begin this kind of social divide we had in this country. Not that it didn't begin it exacerbated the social divide between the 99% and the 1%. And the wealthy have done very well, and the rest of us are paying disproportionately more. You know, coming up is going to be in the public debate as the so-called Buffett rule is debated. Surely what you're doing should be thrown into the mix here, don't you think, in terms of a national debate?
I do. The Buffett rule, in part, was precipitated by Occupy. It's a powerful thing when enough people get together and say, this isn't how we want our government to behave. The Bush tax cuts were extraordinarily costly, and it's wonderful that you brought that up, because that's a side that doesn't appear in our tax day analysis. What you can't see here is money that we don't have because of tax cuts that largely benefited the wealthy. Now, we saw this Occupy movement come to the scene in 2011, and largely because of their action, income inequality became a central issue, a hot topic in Washington, and now we see the Buffett rule under consideration in the Senate and in the White House, and we'll see what happens. It's too early to tell if it will gain traction, but it will continue to be a hot issue throughout the election year.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Mattia Kramer.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Mattia Kramer, who's a senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project, a national nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization dedicated to making complex federal budget information transparent and accessible. The National Priorities Project just released the report Tax Day 2012, which gives the numbers on how federal income taxes were spent in fiscal 2011, down to the penny, giving people a tax receipt for how their money is spent. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The